Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The National Broadcasting Company brings you an address by the President of the United States from the Hotel Mayflower in Washington, D.C. Today and tomorrow, the American Retail Federation is presenting its first Retailers National Forum in the nation's capital. For the first time, retailers of all kinds, large and small, chain and independent alike, have convened to discuss the basic relationships that exist between the retailer and the government. For more than a century, the rising tide of industrial progress has made possible a mass production of goods. This, plus the distribution of those goods, has given the United States its high standard of living. Tonight, the nation's chief executive speaks to the retailers in attendance at this forum, and through them, to the retailers of America. We now present Mr. Louis E. Kirstein, chairman of the Board of Trustees of the American Retail Federation. Mr. Kirstein.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Mr. Kirstein, Dr. Craig, my fellow retailers. I am happy to speak at this first forum of the American Retail Association. I feel a kinship between your business and mine. The backbone of the customers we're both trying to satisfy is the same. In your case, the many small customers whose steady demand for the necessities and a few luxuries of life make up your volume, and in my case, millions of average American families whose standard of living is the practical measure of the success of our democracy. You have one advantage over me, however. Unlike Louis Kirstein, for instance, I have no bargain basement. I hope tonight that you are all cash customers. With one exception, after carefully searching the room, I certify that you are all retailers. That one exception is Henry Morgenthau, Jr., and he's a wholesaler. For you who are in the honorable business of storekeeping, the flow of consumer purchasing power determines the difference between red and black on your account books, and for the nation, the difference between unemployment and prosperity. That is why I want to devote this opportunity to a discussion of a difficult and probably an exceedingly dangerous discussion of government fiscal policy in relation to consumer purchasing power. There are some highbrow columnists and some high-geared economists who say to you that we think, you and I, too much about consumers' purchasing power, and that we look at our economic problem from the wrong end. They say that we should glue all of our attention to the heavy industries and should do everything and anything just to get those industries to work and to get private investors to put up the money to build new buildings and new machines, without regard to the average consumer's need or his ability to use the buildings and the machines after they're erected. By and large, you will find that these experts are the same individuals as those who, just 10 years ago, were telling us that conditions were sound and that we had found the way to end poverty. In those days when we were building luxury office buildings and hotels and apartment houses and for tracking the railroad, doing all this work for consumers who didn't need it as much as these experts thought. Consumers who didn't have the purchasing power to pay for them. And today in 1939, they tell you that conditions are not sound because we are trying to build the sort of houses and structures and other things that our people really need. And because we're trying to make sure that our people have the purchasing power to pay for these things when they're built. They are unrealistic, these people, and theoretical. They were that when they did their prophesying in 1929, and they're just as unrealistic and theoretical and wrong when they're prophesying national bankruptcy in 1939. To translate that into terms of trade, the shelves of heavy industry and the shelves of consumer stores 10 years ago were seriously overstocked. We didn't think so then, perhaps, but we know it now. And you know what happens to merchants of all kinds if they buy twice as much as the public can buy from them. In the last analysis, therefore, consumer buying power is the milk in the coconut of all business, big and little. Whether you're a big department store or do business in a small way in the main street of a small town, your sales are dependent on how much money the average family in your community is earning. Yes, that's a homely way of putting it. But it seems to me that it's an eternal truth. And that's one reason, my friends, why I have talked so much about the one-third of our population that's ill-clad and ill-housed and ill-fed. That third, 40 million Americans, can buy very little at the stores. And therefore, I don't have to tell you that their local stores can order very little at the factories. Some of my friends laugh at me when I stress that. Laugh at efforts, for example, to establish minimum wages and to get more purchasing power for the lowest groups. But the little and the big storekeeper alike understand and know that they will sell more goods if their customers have more money. I want, and I think I have, your help to build up the purchasing power of the average of your customers and mine. How shall we produce more customers with more money in their pockets? One school of thought that we hear a good deal about is what I call the school of the gamblers. Yes, you find some of them in every community, as well as in Wall Street, and some of them of the political variety, even in the halls of the Congress itself. That school of the gamblers is eager to gamble the safety of the nation. The safety of our system of private enterprise are nothing more than their personal hunch that if government will just keep its hands off the economic system, customers will just happen. I use the word gamble because there is no modern experience to support their theory. In fact, modern experience denies their theory. between 1925, let us say, and 1933, let's say March 4th, 33, the government of this country of ours abandoned practically all concern for business and put into effect a tax system in those years, a tax system such as old dealers dream about. Customers and the buying power of customers were just left to happen. And you and I know how many and how much happened. These people who are playing the it may happen hunch today are actually the wildest-eyed radicals in our midst. Because despite proved failures, they want to gamble on their own hunch once more. And in the other school are we conservative and New Dealers. And here's the proof. We are the conservatives because we simply cannot bring ourselves to take radical chances with other people's property and other people's lives. Now, the owner of a private business may have the legal right to take a long chance, a chance that may make or break his personal fortune. If he alone goes out of business, the economic system is not endangered. But the people who run the three branches of our government do not have the moral right to gamble with the well-being of 120 million Americans. If millions of citizens starve, it is no answer to the starving to say that in the sweet by and by, business left to itself will give them a job. Partisans are going around this country scaring parents. Parents who are not starving. By telling these parents of an increased national debt which their grandchildren will have to pay. Certainly that is not as alarming as telling parents who are already starving that an untrammeled business setup will provide their grandchildren with food in 1989. And yet that is what the radical gamblers of business and politics might have to say if they were to put their theories into practice in 1941. Not one of you, hardwood Americans and practical Americans, believe that we could repeat the catastrophe of those years immediately preceding and following 1929 and emerge from it all with our economic and social system unchanged. No businessman, big or little, can fairly or patriotically ask his government to take a course of action that runs that risk. And that is why our school of thought, the conservative school, holds the view that an intelligent nation should rest its faith in arithmetic rather than in a hunch. Today, in order to provide customers for business, your government uses government capital to provide jobs, to prevent farm prices from collapsing, and to build up purchasing power when private capital fails to do it. For example, out of every dollar spent by the federal government to provide jobs, more than 50 cents passes over the counters of the retail merchants of America. We also use what we call social legislation, such as legislation to encourage better pay for low-paid labor, and thereby provide more and better customers for you, such as legislation to protect investors so that they may continue to be your customers without losing their savings in worthless stocks and bonds. I wonder if you have any conception of the number of businessmen and bankers and economists whom I talk with briefly or at length in any given month of the year. I wonder if you have any conception of the variety of suggestions and panaceas that they offer to me. I wonder if you know the very large percentage of them who honestly and in good faith and very naturally think of national problems solely in terms of their own business. I wonder if you will be surprised if I tell you that most of them leave my office saying to me, "Why, Mr. President, I didn't know about that. You've given me a new perspective. You've told me new things that are happening, new causes, new effects. I never thought of the problem in that way before." I sit in my office with a businessman who thinks that the surest way to produce customers is to balance the federal budget now, this year. And I say to him, "How?" Sometimes he says, "How should I know? That's your job." Sometimes he says, "Cut the budget. Cut it straight through, 10% or 20%. And then I take from my desk drawer a fat book. And it's apparent at once from his expression that he's never seen or read the budget of the government of the United States. He tries to change the subject, but I hold him to it. I say, "This budget isn't all of one piece. It's an aggregate of thousands of items. Either we'll have to cut every item, the 10% or the 20% you ask, or if we don't do this, we'll have to cut some items very much more than 10% or 20%. I point out the $1.5 billion for the Army and Navy. He pounds the desk in patriotic fervor and says, "Don't cut that item, not these days." I show him the item of $1 billion for interest on the public debt. He owns some government bonds, and he rejects any cut in his interest. I show him the $1 billion item for war and civil service pensions, and he says, "No, we couldn't get enough popular support to cut those." I mention the $1 billion for running the permanent functions of the regular government departments. And I tell him that they cost less today for those functions than under my predecessor. And he readily agrees that the postman and the G-man and the Forest Service and the custom people cannot be curtailed. The only people he would sever from the payrolls are the tax collectors. Well, that gets us down to a few other big items, totaling over $4 billion, to take care of four major things. Payments to agriculture, for the benefit of agriculture. Federal public works, including PWA and reclamation and flood control. Work relief for the unemployed, including the CCC camps. And assistance for our old people. My visitor agrees with me that we're going through a transitional period, seeking the best way to maintain decent prices for the farm population of America, trying to make them better customers of businessmen, and that even if we have not yet attained the permanent solution, we have got away permanently from 5-cent cotton and 10-cent corn and 30-cent wheat. I come to the public works item. He suggests that can be cut 50%. I happen to know that his community is working tooth and nail to get a grant for a much-needed new high school, and that his county suffered severe property losses from recent floods. And I suggest that we will start public works economy right there and not give the grants, and that we'll defer building the schoolhouse or the levee or the flood control dam for 20 or 30 years. And in every case, I find just what I had suspected. His local chamber of commerce, his local newspapers, are yelling their heads off to have those projects built with federal assistance. And I say to him, consistency, thy name is geography. Why, I think you believe, with the United States Chamber of Commerce, that federal spending on public work should cease, except in your own hometown. And then we come to the item of funds for work relief. There my visitor customer makes a last stand. He wants that cut, and cut hard. We agree that there are between 3 and 4 million American workers who with their families need work to keep alive. I drive him to the inevitable admission that the only alternative to work is to put them on a dole. And that's where I make a stand. I tell my visitor that never so long as I am President of the United States will I condemn millions of men and women to the dry rot of idleness on the dole. Never condemn the business enterprise of the United States to the loss of millions of dollars worth of customer purchasing power. Never take the terrific risk of what would happen to the social and economic and political system of American democracy if we foisted on it an occasional market basket of groceries instead of the chance to work. Yes, I well know the difficulties and the costs of work relief. I do not have to be told by any congressional committee or any United States Chamber of Commerce that 5% of the projects are of questionable value. I know it. Or that 5% of the people on relief projects ought not to be on the rolls. I know that too, and so do you. But when you think of nearly 3 million men and women scattered over all of the 48 states, including the 4 that are not here, and all of the 3,100 and some odd counties in America, I'm proud of the fact that 95% of the projects are good, and 95% of the people are properly on the rolls. And I know that the American people cannot be fooled into believing that the few exceptions actually constitute the general practice. And finally, my friend across the desk murmurs something about old age pensions. He's a bit half-hearted about this, and he finally admits not only the need for dignified support of old age, given and accepted as a new American right for all time to come from now on, but he realizes that over a period of years, this support will have to be extended rather than reduced. You and I, and all Americans, agree that we must work out this problem for the old people of our nation. And so at the end, My visitor leaves convinced in 9 cases out of 10 that I'm not a complete and utter fool, and that balancing the budget today or even next year is a pretty difficult, if not an impossible, job. And now we come to the other side of the budget. The receipts. A few words about federal taxes. Federal taxes. I've discovered after a quarter of a century in public life, one kind or another, interspersed with various forays into business and the law, I have discovered that taxes fall into 3 principal categories. Consumer taxes, like the taxes on cigarettes and gasoline and liquor. And personal taxes, like the personal income taxes and the inheritance taxes. And finally, taxes on corporations. Together, these taxes yield to the federal government about $6 billion. For good, sound business reasons, 2 things seem pretty clear to me. First, especially in view of the unbalanced budget, and in order to bring it more rapidly into balance, we ought not to raise less money from taxation than we are doing now. You have with you a very delightful gentleman, a great merchant of London, Mr. Selfridge. I hope very much that you'll put him in a corner and ask him about the taxes that he pays without a murmur to keep England afloat. And secondly, I think it would be bad for business itself, to shift any further burden onto the consumer taxes. The proportion of consumer taxes to the total is plenty high enough now. Remember, as businessmen and as retailers, that any further taxes on consumers, like a sales tax, means that the consumers can buy fewer goods at your store. Therefore, I want to leave the proportion between these 3 groups of taxes about where they are today. That means that if we reduce the so-called deterrent taxes on business corporations, we must find substitute taxes to lay on business corporations. That language, that thought, is as plain as no shoe. Let me give you an example of what I call making a mountain out of a molehill. There's a great hullabaloo for the repeal of the undistributed earnings tax. You would think that this was the principal deterrent to business today. And yet it's a simple fact that out of $1,100,000,000 paid to the federal government by corporations, less than $20 million comes to the government from the undistributed earnings tax, less than 2% of the total. Let me proceed. I am wholly willing to have this $20 million tax, this less than 2% of the total, wholly repealed on 2 simple conditions, which are based not on whim, not on hunch, but on principle. The first is that this $20 million shall be raised by some other form of tax against corporations and not against other groups of taxpayers, and that it shall be raised in such a way that it will be paid by the 28,000 bigger corporations earning more than $25,000 a year, and not by the 175,000 little corporations that earn less than that sum. And the second condition is that in the repeal of this tax, we shall not return to the old tax evasion loophole, by which a very small group of people with incomes in the very high upper brackets used to be able, up to 2 years ago, to leave their profits in closely held corporations, thus avoiding the full rates of the higher brackets on their personal incomes. It seems to me that patriotic people everywhere will not want to go back to that old pernicious practice. I have talked with you at some length about the radicals who have the hunch that we ought to go back to the conditions of 1929, about performing a major operation by amputating present functions of government, and about the efforts of some who would reduce corporation taxes and add to consumer taxes. But I would not have you believe that the conservative attitude of this administration plans as any permanent part of our American system an indefinite continuation of excess of outgo over cash receipts. This week, I understand, is dedicated by the opponents of the administration to merchandising horror about the national debt. We're having a national debt week, like a national cleanup, a national paint-up week. Right. Let's talk about the debt in businessmen's terms. In the first place, a nation's debt, like the deposit liability of a bank, must be considered in relation to its assets. A large part of the government debt is offset by debts owed to the government. Loans of many kinds made on a business basis by the RFC and the Farm Credit Administration, for example. Loans that are now being repaid on schedule. Those assets are just as sound as the loans made by the bankers of the country. Another portion of the national debt is invested in federally owned enterprises, like Boulder Dam, which is finished, and Bonneville Dam, which is finished, and Grand Coulee Dam, a great irrigation project where we hope to put the Dust Bowl farmers, which will be finished in another year or so. Projects like that that are paying out, that will pay out, principal and interest over a period of years. A third part of the debt has been invested in works like flood control, dams and levees, to save us from heavy future losses. They will pay for themselves in a very few years by eliminating annual property damage, which each year has run literally into hundreds of millions of dollars. Pay by the saving of taxable values, which otherwise would have floated off downstream. The next thing to remember about the debt is that government, like businessmen, is investing in order to create a higher volume of business income, and therefore a bigger net yield for government and for business. National income will be greater tomorrow than it is today because government has had the courage to borrow idle capital and put it and idle labor to work. The year before I took office, 1932, our national income was $39 billion. In 1937, it got up to $69 billion. In 1938, it went back almost to $60 billion. And today, it's running at the rate of better than $65 billion. At $80 billion, and this is an $80 billion country, the income from present taxes will be more than sufficient to meet expenditures on the present scale. And actually, when that time comes, the expenditures will be less because our relief bill will be lowered. Today, with no danger of surplus of goods overhanging the market, just because we have tried to keep consumer purchasing power up to production, the nation is in an excellent position to move forward into a period of greater production and greater employment. That is my sincere belief, and I believe that it's your belief, too. So when, at the end of this famous week we're getting into, you see all the crocodile tears about the burden of on our grandchildren to pay the government debt, remember this. Our national debt, after all, is an internal debt owed not by the nation, but to the nation. If our children have to pay interest on it, they will pay that interest themselves, to themselves. And a reasonable internal debt is not going to impoverish our children or put the nation into bankruptcy. But if we do not allow a democratic government to do the things that need to be done and hand down to our children a deteriorated nation, their legacy will be not a legacy of abundance or even a legacy of poverty amid plenty, but a legacy of poverty amid poverty. Don't you agree that it's better to work unitedly to balance national income and national outgo at a level where government can do the things that have to be done to preserve our people and our resources, than to play the speculative hunch and withdraw government from lending and investment, from conserving property, and from providing work for our capital and our people in the hope that in some mysterious way a miracle will occur, a miracle which our only experience under modern conditions has proved impossible. I keep saying, do not lose sight of the forest because of the trees. Let us always distinguish principles and objectives from the tails and mechanics. You cannot expect this administration to alter the principles and objectives for which we have struggled for more than 6 years. But if you approve of the purposes that lie behind our policies, but believe our operating methods can be improved, then your help and your counsel are welcome, doubly welcome, in this administration. And that relates to the details of taxation, the details of relief, the details of every administrative branch in Washington and in every state. If I have spoken to you seriously tonight, it's because I believe that you too, are thinking of the well-being of every man, woman, and child in our country. That you go along with me in every effort that I can make for the preservation of world peace and for the preservation of domestic peace. Not merely an armed peace that foregoes war for the moment, but a peace that comes from a knowledge, both at home and abroad, that there will be no further acts of aggression on the part of nations, on the part of groups, or on the part of individuals. You think rightly of profits in your business. So does every other American, and so do I. But we are not ruled by the thought of profits alone. More and more we seek the making of profits by processes that will not destroy our fellow men who are our neighbors. That is one of the functions of your government. It seeks your cooperation in the extension of that ideal. It is open to your advice and to your help. because it believes that its fundamental ideals and yours are just the same. That is why I came to you not in the spirit of criticism, not wielding a big stick, but coming with a simple plea for your assistance as American citizens in working out our common problems with goodwill and with the maintenance of the ideals of peace.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States addressing the Retailers National Forum in Washington. The forum was arranged by the American Retail Federation, which comprises some 25 state retail associations with a membership of 200,000 to discuss the basic relationship between retailers and the governor. More than 1,200 retailers and their guests heard the President's speech here tonight, and many, many thousands more have attended the dinner by radio. The President turns now and shakes hands with Mr. Louis Kirstein, who introduced him to this audience. Mr. Kirstein is Chairman of the Board of Trustees of the American Retail Federation. The speaker's table and all of the tables, as a matter of fact, tonight filled with notables of the retail business and of the Congress. Some 225 or 50 members of the Congress alone have come here tonight as guests of this dinner. The orchestra plays Hail to the Chief, and the President has now left the room. This program reached you direct from the Hotel Mayflower in Washington. This is the National Broadcasting Company.